The unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect truth is seldom met with, even in 100,000 myriad kalpas. Now we can see and hear it. We can remember and accept it. I vow to make the Buddha's truth one with myself. Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. Thank you all for coming today and celebrating with us this transfer of merit ceremony. And many of you, this marks the end of your retreat as well. And we hope that you've been finding it of great benefit or of some benefit in your religious practice. And I had initially planned to do a talk a couple of weeks ago when we celebrated Reverend Master Jiyu, our master and late abbess, her annual memorial festival. And unfortunately, it was too ill. Reverend Master Daishin kindly did it for me and did a superb job. So very grateful to him. I had a very bad tooth infection and was laid up for over a week. So that was a good lesson in itself and might be the subject of another Dharma talk. But just training with suddenly not being able to do very much and having something very serious going on in your body, and certainly very humbling. But it did make me very aware of the merit that is in our training, the merit that was coming to me, and the value of this practice of transferring merit. And I certainly felt very tangibly to be the recipient of a great deal of merit and love, and very direct care as well. You know, there you are. Your body doesn't do what you want it to do. It really reminds one that our body is not our own. And there's a great little passage that I read recently from the great forest Thai master, John Cha, where he says, you know, your body isn't going to behave the way you want it to. If you get a headache, it'll just do it. It won't ask you first, you know. If you get an infection, it's going to just do it. It won't ask you. And that, you know, there's a tremendous lesson in that because we suffer from this illusion that we're this body and we're this mind and so on. So that was a valuable teaching. So it leads me to perhaps go back to some of what I was going to talk about a couple of weeks ago with regards to some of my favorite teachings of Reverend Master Jiyu. One of them being that she taught us that the body has its rights. And, you know, it takes some training to understand what that means, but it has its life, it has its purpose, and it needs care. And certainly that was, I was very aware of the care that it needed if I wanted to be able to continue to make good use of it for the rest of my life. And it was just a tooth infection, you know, but still, it was pretty serious. So some very good lessons out of that. But she taught us, and I think this teaching speaks to, not only how we view ourselves, but how we judge ourselves also. We sometimes think we've done something horribly wrong. There's something basically wrong with us when we become ill. And it's just very natural. Everyone's going to become ill at some point, and we can make good use of those experiences. So I hope I have been able to do that to some extent. But what I really wanted to go into in more detail here is, again, in training with Reverend Master Jiyu, how she increasingly impressed upon us the importance in Buddhist practice, as I've alluded to, of not judging ourselves. And for that matter, not judging others. And I'd like to talk a little about what that means. First of all, Buddhism does not teach this concept of there being an original sin. Now, I was raised with this idea. I never understood it. It always made me feel bad because it sort of made me feel like I could never quite get away from this original badness somehow. Now, that was my young mind, and perhaps I didn't have the right teachers or didn't hear the teaching properly. But I think it's something perhaps that many of us suffer from, even if we haven't had that kind of teaching, weren't raised with that sort of thing, we may have some of this in our cultural thinking. And it can be very insidious and I think potentially very damaging. So there's this idea that we're born with original sin. But rather, Buddhism teaches that our original nature is empty of a selfish or separate self, sometimes translated as void. But really it means not separate, not empty of a separateness, and unstained and pure. So this is sort of a premise. This is kind of a starting point in Buddhism. And often it takes us many years of training. Rev. Master Ji used to say, if we come from certain, and I don't mean to be critical, I have great respect for all the religious traditions, but we do grow up with misunderstandings. And she used to say, when she had monks who were raised in certain traditions, that it took her 3 years to get them out of the, you know, the mind that believed that they had this inherent badness, as one of my fellow monastics puts it, you know, this suffering from this idea of having this inherent badness you just can't run get away from, you know. And it's kind of the default setting that you always come back to. and it can be very damaging, actually. It may seem virtuous at times, but really, actually, it's very unnecessary. And I'd like to offer and share some teaching that might help with that as well. Perhaps you're not like me, but I think we have a little bit of this. And so how do we work with our faults and our shortcomings in Buddhism whilst at the same time having faith in and trusting and growing in experience of this pure original nature that Buddhism talks about? Please come in. And this has huge implications for our daily lives and spiritual training. So the other aspect that I'd like to bring out today of training with Reverend Master Jiu was the importance of trusting and studying to some extent, reading, reciting the scriptures, really of taking in the Dharma. This weekend, those of you who are new here have been learning about our meditation practice. Perhaps you've had some experience in Buddhism before coming, perhaps not, doesn't matter. And we do put a lot of emphasis on learning to meditate and then on introducing the Buddhist precepts and training therein. These are two very important fundamental aspects of our practice. And along with that, the importance of trusting the Dharma. I know I suffered years ago from this idea, I just gravitated that way, that as long as I was meditating all the time, everything was okay. You know, I just had to be meditating. And it was true. I mean, really, if I were really meditating 100% all the time, probably everything would have been fine. But I remember times when my practice became one-sided. And I remember some of the... and I became a little bit afraid of the religious aspects at times. And so, you know, we can get into our own little worlds a bit too much if we become one-sided with the practice. On the other hand, if we are simply studying the scriptures in an intellectual manner, studying the Dharma as an intellectual interest, and there's nothing wrong with that, but if we leave it at that, of course, we're not going to get very far either. The two have to be in balance. And our scriptures have such tremendous encouragement in them. Now, when I was a younger trainee, I didn't find them very accessible, but we do have these daily scriptures that we recite that are more accessible. I mean, some of the long ones, you know, the ones, the volumes of scriptures, I found those too hard to get into. Now, you know, I can read them for some reason and they make sense to me as a result of my practice. So you have to just work with what you've got. But to remember, to use that in your practice. If you don't have scriptures available, some sort of Dharma teaching, or go to a teacher who teaches the Dharma and ask advice now and then. So important to balance that with the meditation practice. And Reverend Master used to teach that the scriptures were written at death's door. which I found very interesting. When you read them, you realize that they take you, you know, they go to the heart of the matter. They take you to the max, as we say. They aren't, you know, they don't, there's just endless help and teaching in them. So whether they are written by people who were actually dying, or perhaps at the time of a great awakening experience, perhaps when one is dying to self. Perhaps we've all had some little experience of that, at least, when we've written something down that has been particularly important and meaningful at those times. And it's really good to heed that. So the scriptures are not something that is just have been written in the past. In Buddhism, the Buddhist canon, if you like, is constantly being added to. We don't have a Buddhist Bible that was written centuries ago and ended there. Not to say anybody else does, but just, you know, one can think that. Those are the only important writings. But they're being added to by masters, by trainees. And, you know, just to extend that, Reverend Master Astor last week talked about Aoyama Roshi, a wonderful female Zen master that we had the good fortune of meeting when I was in Thailand at a Buddhist women's conference. And she talks in one of her teachings, one of her essays in Zen Seeds, her book, of how she has found that every person has their own scripture and, in a sense, is their own scripture. And that's an interesting reflection. And we'll get into that a bit more and why that is so. So we also have our own scripture that comes from our own training, our own flavor of the Dharma. And that points to a different way of relating to people, perhaps, tuning into their scripture. Now, that's a novel idea, isn't it? And perhaps one that will help us to listen and meet people in a different way, perhaps. We here have this practice of the gassho, where we acknowledge each other's Buddha nature. Perhaps when doing that, we can keep that teaching in mind. I find that really interesting and helpful. Personally, I have even often felt sometimes when you're just sitting quietly in the kitchen and you're listening to the, you're doing some work quietly and you hear the fridge motor going, I start to hear the ancestral line being chanted, you know. Sort of happens with practice. You know, you've been practicing and reciting scriptures over and over and over. When you hear the freeway, you start to hear the teaching on Uji. And I don't mean to put forth any sort of sense of holiness, but it just happens with continued practice. The scriptures are there all the time, and we can tap into them. And if your mind starts to go there, if you start to hear that, enjoy it. Pay attention to it. Allow it to brighten your heart and your mind. Allow yourself to be ennobled and elevated by that. And we can have that experience in nature. It's not something that should, you know, transport us to another world or cause us to lose touch with reality. It's not that kind of thing. It's very ordinary, and it just adds a kind of beauty and loveliness to daily life. So having said that, I'm going to read a little bit of an article, or perhaps most of a short article, that Reverend Master Ji wrote, one of my favorite teachings. Initially, this talk was going to be about my favorite things. And I realized, as a monk perhaps of a number of years, and anyone who's been training for any length of time begins to realize that their favorite things have very much to do with Dharma teaching. You know, I mean, I do have lots of things I like and I want and many desires, but they don't have, most of them, nearly as much hold as they used to. And these are the things that truly are my favorites. So this is from an article that she wrote actually in 1978, and it was reprinted in the Journal of the Order of Buddhist Contemplatives in 1990. And if you don't know, you probably all heard about the Journal of our Order, the order that we belong to, and that it's available to anyone who'd like to subscribe. This article is called The Water of the Spirit. And it says here in the introduction that the scriptural passages quoted in this article are paraphrased from Stiramati's discourse on the Mahayana Dharmadhatu. And I'm not going to go into the details of that. You can always look that up sometime if you'd like to. Dharmadhatu meaning the Dharma realm, Dharma world. Okay, so I'd like to comment a little bit on this teaching and also to being the transfer of merit ceremony and day today, it perhaps will show us a little of the source of this merit that we're talking about and how we have to be careful not to judge our practice, because we may often feel that we don't have a lot of merit in our practice or very little. And what is there to give? What do we have to give? She's quoting from the scripture and it's paraphrased. I'm going to paraphrase the whole thing a little bit. Nirvana is recognized and known through bodhicitta. They are one and the same thing. Bodhicitta is the name given to a form of the Dharmakaya, the Dharma body, as it manifests itself in the human heart and body. Bodhicitta, bodhi is awakened, means awakened mind. So it's referring to our own natural awakened mind. We have many ways of expressing this. Kizan sometimes uses the term original nature, lord of the house. Okay, so they are one and the same thing, nirvana and bodhicitta. It's the name given to a form of the Dharmakaya or Dharma body as it manifests itself in the human heart and body. That includes us. That is its perfection, or put otherwise, its liberation from all egocentric impurities, which constitutes the state of nirvana. So this is, you know, in our training, and one way of looking at the training that we've been talking about is to let go of, convert these impurities, convert these things that have gotten in the way of our experiencing our bodhicitta. So Reverend Master here comments, Reverend Master Jiu, when someone has seen, and she's speaking from her experience here, when someone has seen suffering's cause and done something completely about it, one has liberated oneself from the impurities. Allowing the bodhicitta to flow freely throughout the body and mind and universe. And this liberating oneself from impurities, again, is the practice of meditation, the keeping of the precepts, the doing everything we can during the day to turn towards our true nature. And through that, the cause of suffering becomes more clear. We begin to see what it is that is causing us to be in distress. This flowing, this is called the blood of the Buddhas. It is that which goes from ancestor to ancestor. And that's what's passed on. You know, when we chant the ancestral line, one of the reasons we chant it is a reminder of how this has flown through the centuries to the present time and to us. And we have the choice, of course, of passing it on as well. If you can truly comprehend this place, you not only know it by faith, you know it physically, mentally, spiritually. There are many symbols of it, always connected with something liquid, because of the flowingness and the changingness of it. Rivers, fountains, a rain of Dharma that comes as nectar down, as was spoken of in the scripture that we chanted today, Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva, the sweet tea which is poured over the newborn Buddha, all of these are connected with the bodhicitta, a means of understanding the raining down of love, which is as a sweet nectar. And it is this which one can feel and know as a result of cleansing the impurities in the body, mind, and spirit. It is the knowing of this itself and the experiencing of it which constitutes nirvana. It is a knowable thing. Once you have experienced it, you will never forget it. Once you have experienced it, you will never want any other form of love, for there is nothing that is higher than it, nothing more exquisite, nothing more fulfilling. The bodhicitta, the certainty of the eternal love, the experiencing of the unborn, the undying, and the uncreated. And so you can see Reverend Master Ju, and this is from my experience in training with her, typical and one of the just great blessings of her teaching, there was just no doubt there that this was a knowable thing. It's not something mysterious, elusive, that's off in you know, some other world or other place that is not knowable, not experienceable. And as we practice, as we continue our training, little by little, we grow in the experience of it. We may not have, we have to begin with faith, but as we gain an experience, and again, the experience is not something to get attached to, but nonetheless, we must allow ourselves to be comforted by it, to allow it in, accept that as well as all our faults and shortcomings. If we don't do that, we tend to spin our wheels round and round for most of our lives, worrying about all the things that are wrong with us. Of course, we have to do something about ourselves. We do have to do something, you know, about our greeds and our angers and our delusions. But they're really just passing things, you know. They're not part of our original nature in terms of something. They're not obstacles in that sense, put it that way. I'm going to continue quoting from the scripture a bit here. So this is free from compulsive activities. It has no beginning. It has no end. It cannot be defiled by impurities, no matter how impure we may become. It cannot be obscured by egocentric, individualistic prejudices, no matter how prejudiced we may become. It is incorporeal. It is the very spiritual essence or the blood of Buddhas. It is the source of all virtues, earthly as well as transcendental. It is constantly becoming, yet its original purity is never lost. Now, how's that for inspiration? Eh? See what I mean? You know, if you don't read these things once in a while and really contemplate them and take them to heart, we forget. We just forget. The press of daily life, the press of, you know, all the things that we have to do, the press of our sorrows and tensions can cause us to forget. Everybody does. The most experienced trainees do. In fact, we might be even more likely to after you've been doing it for some time, because you think that sometimes you can sort of coast along on, you know, unconsciously we think that we're kind of, we can coast along on what we've been doing all this time. But in fact, no matter how far you've gone in training, you always have to work at it. And in a way, more things come to you, more responsibilities, more awareness of what needs to be done. And sometimes you see more of the sadness and sorrow of the world too, so you might even have to work harder after you've been at it for a while to remind yourself. And that's why in the monastery we chant these same scriptures day in and day out and do the best we can to get to the meditation hall and keep our practice up during the day. We need it. Everybody needs it. Again, quoting the scripture, it may be likened unto the ever-shining sunlight, which may temporarily be hidden behind the clouds. All the modes of passion and sin, or shall I say suffering, all the modes of suffering arising from egoism may sometimes darken the light of the bodhicitta. But the bodhicitta itself forever remains free from these external impurities. It may again be likened unto all comprehending space, which remains eternally identical, whatever happenings and changes may occur in things enveloped therein. Now that's an interesting statement, isn't it? I'm going to read that again. All the modes of passion and suffering arising from egoism may sometimes darken the light of the bodhicitta, but the bodhicitta itself forever remains free from these external impurities. It may again be likened unto all comprehending space, or all embracing space, which remains eternally identical, it doesn't change, whatever happenings and changes may occur in things enveloped therein. So it holds everything, all the changes, all the ups and downs and ins and outs. and itself remains eternal. When the bodhicitta manifests itself in a relative world, it appears to be subject to constant becoming. But in reality, it transcends all determinations. It is above the reach of birth and death. So, that gives us something to work towards, doesn't it? Reverend Master Jiyu says, "It is indeed the unborn, the uncreated, the undying. And no matter what you have done, this exquisite thing flows on unstained." That you do not feel it is because you're too concerned with your external ideas, our external theories and our external opinions, because we have not stayed still enough within, just to let it flow. Let it flow by, let it flow on. Or, when we've felt it, we've tried to grab it, and we've had the bubble break in our hands. Just let it flow on and flow by you. Listen to it and enjoy it, feel it and know it. I think sometimes when we, you know, I remember once talking with my niece who was in college, one of my nieces. She was writing a paper for her religious studies class on Buddhism, and she had an assignment where she was supposed to, she chose Buddhism, but she could write on any religion. And the students were supposed to contact a teacher or a leader of their religion. You know, so she contacted me, her aunt, because she knew I was a teacher of Buddhism. And I thought, that was nice. And so she interviewed me over the phone for about an hour for her paper. And I asked her, you know, what did she think of Buddhism from her studies in school and so on. And, you know, she had a little bit of the sense of it kind of seeing... It was a little hard and negative, you know. I think there was a lot of teaching on no self and no this and no that, and she couldn't quite get, you know, gee, it was a little depressing, you know. And I think that is not an uncommon thing, because some of those teachings that were given by the Buddha in countries like India, you know, 2,000 years ago, where there were many gods, and he was trying to get them away from this idea of, you know, worshiping something outside themselves always, and to look within. And yet when you transport that exactly to our culture, sometimes where we have a lot of depression, you know, and worry about our original badness, people can think, oh my God, you know, what is there to hold on to, you know, inadvertently, unless they have further teaching. So I found that very interesting, and that's one of the reasons why, and I think this is not an uncommon experience for many of us when we encounter some of the writings of Buddhism. Unless you're reading something from a very, you know, experienced master, people who are actually doing the training, or a scripture like this. So the scripture goes on, so long as it, capital I, remains buried under innumerable sins, or shall we say again, sufferings, arising from ignorance and egoism, it is productive of no earthly or heavenly benefit. So it's there, like Bodhidharma used to talk, you know, he taught about how it was like a light in an urn, a lamp in an urn that was all sooted up, and you kind of had a sense there was a light in there, but and most of us do. We all have some sense of it. You know, one of the laws of the universe is that all beings have intuitive knowledge of the Buddha nature. We wouldn't be here if we didn't have quite a bit of that intuitive knowledge. And I don't think beings would make it very far in their lives if they didn't have some intuitive knowledge of that, which is another interesting, I think, observation. But it is sooted up and, you know, we don't see it. We don't trust it. We don't quite know it. Like the lotus flower whose petals are yet unfolded, like the gold that is deeply entombed under the debris of dung and dirt, or like the light of the full moon eclipsed, and there's a bit of we've left out here, the bodhicitta, when blindfolded by the clouds of passion, in the sense of attachments, clinging, avarice or greed, the clouds of passion, avarice, ignorance, and folly, it does not reveal its intrinsic spiritual worth. Rumi Master Jiyu goes on to say, yet it remains within the person and is to be found in all beings. This is how to look at one's fellow men and women, for that matter, one's fellow beings. And if you do not look at them in this way, you will never see a Buddha. You will always see a tall person or a thin person or a short person or a sleeping person or a whatever kind of person. You will never feel the beauty of that water flow through you, and there's nothing like that. So to end with another final passage of the scripture, I'm going to maybe paraphrase this. It says, destroy at once with all your might and main all those entanglements. Whoa, how do you do that? Well, what comes up for me is letting go of them, a continuous letting go of the entanglements, the clinging to things harmful. And we all have some idea of what that is. I bet you can all name at least one thing. I can name quite a few. And so just letting go of them. Then, like the full-bloomed lotus flower, like genuine gold purified from dirt and dust, like the moon in a cloudless sky, like the sun in its full glory, like Mother Earth producing all kinds of cereals, like the ocean containing innumerable treasures, the eternal bliss of the bodhicitta will be upon all sentient beings and will flow through us and in us. All sentient beings are then emancipated from the misery of ignorance and folly, foolishness, delusion. Their hearts are filled with love and sympathy and free from the clinging to things worthless, basically to what doesn't work. And she's got this underlined here. However defiled and obscured the bodhicitta may find itself in profane hearts, it is essentially the same as that in all the Buddhas. That's big. And she ends the article by saying, this is one of the most beautiful lines ever written. And I have to agree. However defiled by dirt it may become, it is essentially the same bodhicitta. However murky you make the water, we make the water, it is essentially the same water of the spirit that flows through all Buddhas. So that's just a little article by Reverend Master Jiyu. And gives you some idea of her teaching and how, you know, helpful she's been to so many of us. And this points to, again, the importance of not judging ourselves and not, for that matter, judging others. I think if we have a tendency to be judgmental of ourselves, I've suffered from that a lot, it tends to flip over into judging others too. What is that judgment? You know, for me, it doesn't mean that we don't see our faults. We don't see things that we're doing that are creating suffering. Obviously, we have to, or we can't make progress in training, and we can't get to where we know and experience this for ourselves. What it means is we don't have to put that extra little punch in there, you know? For me, the judgment has a kind of heaviness to it. There's an impulsive, and it can be cultural, it can be conditioned through our education, or I think for some of us anyway, in Western education, we're a little bit conditioned to come up with some hypothesis and then to prove it true and hold it there, you know, and defend it, even if maybe it's not quite right or maybe it doesn't always make sense, you know. It's a little, you know, it's understandable, but it's very difficult. You know, any view has many different aspects to it, and any, you know, right view in Buddhism isn't something that is one-sided. You know, it's multifaceted. It has millions, billions, and uncountable facets to it, you know. So when we have our views, when we have these ideas about who we are, opinions about ourselves and others, we just have to be mindful of what we're doing with them. They may arise, and that's not necessarily a problem. What is the problem is when we add that little punch, that's it. That's what it's about. That's what that person's about. Or myself. This is even worse, you know. This is as far as I can get. You know, I'm always like this, and that's never going to change, you know. And Yes, we have our tendencies. We have our shortcomings. And we do need to be modest and humble about those because we can forget them. And they can do harm. We can do harm if we don't notice them. But on the other hand, the way that we learn to see and do some these things and do something about them in Buddhist training is not by judging them, but simply by sitting still within the experience of what we see and taking note and being willing to learn from it. You know, it's hard to do, but we can do it. As many of you know, the Shurangama Sutra talks about this wonderful passage in the Shurangama Sutra that talks about how, the awakened mind, the mind of true awareness, sees error, but is not itself in error. You know, and this is what we learn to, this is how we learn to see things as a result of meditation. We see the error in ourselves, and we might see the errors or the problems that exist in the world and with other people. Of course we do, but they're not fixed things. These are all things that can change, and they're all held within this greater thing that Reverend Master was talking about. If we can't open to that bigger picture, then we limit our experience and we start getting into conflict with people. And you know, I was reflecting in preparing this on how much conflict in the world is the result of this kind of problem, you know, where we get an idea, opinion about somebody, they're not doing it the way we do it, ours is the best way, and so on and so forth, or whatever, you know, but the judgment, the feeling that we have to somehow make it right ourselves rather than trusting our meditation. Now, on the other hand, we do have to make decisions. We have to be able to discern things, right? We have to be able to help in some way. And how do we learn to help in the best possible way if we're not judging? Again, I would say the practice. The practice is what helps with that. And it comes out of the practice. There's a difference between applying the wisdom arising from the mind of meditation, and it will, compassion and wisdom will arise if we're practicing meditation and precepts and taking the scriptures and Dharma teachings to heart. There's a difference between that and the way that we respond out of that to what we might sometimes call wise discernment. And there's a difference between that and what usually comes from our discriminatory mind, the mind that is trying to figure it all out with our heads and that kind of picks and over things and picks and chooses. Great Master Dogen, one of our great ancestors that you've probably heard about, who brought Soto Zen Buddhism from China to Japan, as most of you know, reading his works, he has very often you hear the theme. He talks a lot about training that discriminatory mind of yours, you know, always pointing out, watch what that discriminatory mind is doing. It's mentioned in so many ways, so many times in different ways, not getting caught up in opposites. He says when the opposites arise in his rules for meditation, the Buddha mind is lost. It's not seen, it's not known. We can't know and experience and allow it to function in our lives. So that it's more a matter of just seeing, watching what that mind is doing. And why do we have that? And then also observing how it, the hold that it has on it lessens as we continue our training. Because we also have to see that side of it. We'll forget. So perhaps we will have come to a certain point in our training where we're doing rather well. And something will happen. We'll become ill. A relationship might fall apart. That certainly has happened to me. There's just a big change. We lose a loved one. Whatever. Your country's at war. You know, everything falls apart. I have found that, to my great shock, that I had, you know, we have these ideas that somehow if we're training, it's all going to go the way we had in mind. You know, we have this idea of how it's supposed to go, and if we're really doing our training, it's all going to work out that way. It's kind of, you know, innocent in a way, but we have to let go of that. It's usually going to end up better in the long run than we think, actually, but in the short run, it can seem way worse and way different and can be very discouraging, right? And that's when we can start to really judge ourselves. I had some very considerable experience with this and created a lot of suffering for myself, blaming myself for all sorts of things. Some of them I was responsible for, but you know, if you're giving yourself a hard time, you really can't see what it is and what needs to be done. So it's very important to be mindful of that. And to be, you know, as I say, keep taking the Buddhist teachings to heart. Things will change, that there is this continual flow, and to keep up the practice, and we'll come out the other end. So Reverend Master, certainly this is something that she's told me a number of times, and I remember her often saying to people, since the Buddha mind, as we've been reading, since it does not, the eternal does not judge us, you know, why do we judge ourselves? That's a good reflection. That's a very helpful reflection. Or other people, for that matter, if we lean more in that direction. Why do we do that? And that's something to sit still with, that question. It can be very, very fruitful. And once we let go of that human tendency, we can begin to really make some serious progress on the path, just seeing and just responding to seeing. So there has to be that sitting still, that not grasping after thoughts and things, not pushing them away. Otherwise, we'll remain stuck with our habitual impulses and these judgmental reactions. Ultimately, the bodhicitta is going to come through, but we can do a lot to help it in this life. In fact, we can make this life an expression of it if we're willing just to keep going each day, little by little, and looking at other beings in a different way. So, yeah, part of this for me in my experience too is when we experience suffering, we can get so caught up in it and be kind of immersed in it that we can't hear the bodhicitta. We don't let, I used to think of it as I'm not letting the eternal get a word in edgewise, you know. My mind is so filled with the suffering and the thoughts and the things I have to do that I'm not hearing this little prompting, you know, of the heart, which comes from this bodhicitta, which is always there. You know, this too shall pass, just keep going, you know. Finally, I remember I did listen to it, and that's why I'm here, fortunately. But, and many of you had similar experience, I know, and it's good to share those stories with others. But without listening to that, without making that effort, and without cultivating actively a faith and a trust, Rev. Master Jiu refers to it as turning the stream of compassion within, stream of love, the stream of trust within. You really have to trust your basic original nature as being pure. And even if everything that your mind tells you and everything in your education or conditioning tells you otherwise, don't believe it completely. Don't act on it whenever you can possibly. And that's, I believe, how we really help this world of suffering and how we really help others. Unless we're doing that, and, you know, as best we can each day, just in little ways, practicing kindness and giving expression to this, looking at other beings, hearing their scripture, seeing the Buddha nature, appreciating something they do, even if they've got a lot of problems, expressing that when we can. And just by doing that, I think that is how the big things get changed too. Big things happen as a result of lots of little things. And so it doesn't look like much, but as a Buddhist, our focus is always coming back to sitting still, having faith, doing something about ourselves. And that's the source of true merit. One person turning towards that, the ripples of that extend very far, and we can't see that necessarily. We don't have to even think about it. We just have to trust it and just keep going. And that's why we do these ceremonies. We don't know where the merit's going. It's said that only a Buddha really knows. And in our hearts, something knows that aspect of ourselves that is of Buddha. Well, every aspect is of a Buddha, but that is that which is at one with the Buddha knows. We don't know the suffering that other beings are going through. It's always good to consider these things. And if we train in this way, true help will come. It doesn't have to come. It doesn't have to be heroic. I think the real heroism in Buddhism is this practice of just keeping going day in and day out, doing the very best we can to do something about ourselves, to offer help where possible, in little ways. It might mean setting up, great programs to help people in disasters. It may mean all kinds of dramatic things, or it might just mean doing the best you can to look after your family or make sure the dishes are clean and your house is clean and you're not spreading disease. You know, it could be something as simple as that. If we're not focused on these daily, these little things in our daily lives, if we're not willing to see those as being helpful, then the big things aren't going to work either. Great. And we're coming up to Thanksgiving. And when I was reflecting on this, I was thinking also that this teaching is a lot like the teaching in a scripture that we're going to recite at our Festival of Thanksgiving. And we have a Festival of Thanksgiving. As Buddhists, we celebrate a ceremony in the morning of gratitude, of giving thanks. We're going to be chanting a passage, a part of a chapter called the Scripture of the Parable of the Herbs. And it's from one of our bigger scriptures that's important to Soto Zen, called the Lotus Scripture. And in that, it also talks about, the Buddha talks about how the Dharma is like a great cloud raining, offering rain and nourishment to all things, equally bestowing water, rain on all things, whether they're small herbs, plants, trees, big trees, shrubs, everything. There grow the plants, trees, and the herbs, trees big or small, the shoots of all the ripening grain, sugar cane, and the grapevine. All these by rain are fertilized and are abundantly enriched. All the trees, superior, middle, inferior, all each according to their size, grow and develop roots, stalks, branches, and leaves, blossoms and fruits in their brilliant colors. By the pouring of the one rain, all become fresh and glossy. So it's allowing this to flow through us that brings luster to our lives. Just as their bodies, forms, and natures are divided into great and small, so the enriching rain, though one and the same, makes each flourish well in its own way. In the same manner, the Buddha also appears in the world, like a great cloud universally covering all things and showering. So this image again of the rain of the Dharma showering equally in all beings, no matter who. And that applies to the worst of criminals in prisons and any one of us who may think we've done something awful that we're never going to be able to amend, whatever it happens to be. Let the water of compassion, let the water of the Dharma flow through you and heal that, and just don't buy into that. And that's my talk for today. Thank you.